another flash of clay in that woman. How do I bring it up? I lean past her for strawberries. Mom reaches out to flick my cheek with a finger. It's when you say things like that I remember how very young you are. Then her face softens. I know it'll be hard for you to get used to Tracy being gone. Me too. It'll be quiet around here. You understand that I'm going to have to be working hard all summer, don't you, sweetie? I nod. The house already seems still, without Tracy's off-key singing in the shower or her heels hammering down the stairs. Mom pulls the filtered water out of the refrigerator and pours it into the tea kettle. Clay says I'm bigger than this position. I could be important. I could be something more than the woman with the trust fund who bought my way into power. There were a lot of editorials that said exactly that when she won the first time. I read them, winced, and hid the paper, hoping Mom never saw them. But of course she did. It's been so long since anyone has looked at me and really seen me, she adds suddenly, standing there holding the filtered water. Your father, well, I thought he did. But then after him, you get busy and you get older, and nobody really looks your way anymore. You and Tracy. She's off to college in the fall. That'll be you in another year. And I think, it's their turn now. Where did my chance go? It only took Clay a little while to come to terms with the fact that I had teenage daughters. He sees me, Samantha. I can't tell you how good that feels. She turns and looks at me, and I've never seen her glow like this. How can I say, Mom, I think he might be seeing someone else, too. I think of Jace Garrett, how he seems to understand without me having to explain things. Does Mom feel that way with Clay? Please, don't let him be some skeevy womanizer. I'm glad, Mom, I say. I hit blend, and the kitchen fills with the sound of pulverizing strawberries and ice. She brushes the hair off my forehead, then sets the filtered water down and hovers near my elbow until I turn off the blender. Then, silence. You two, you and Tracy, she finally says to my back, are the best things that ever happened to me, personally. But there's more to life than personal things. I don't want you to be the only things that ever happened to me. I want... Her voice trails off, and I turn around to find her looking away, off somewhere I can't see. Suddenly, I feel afraid for her. As she stands there, her expression dreamy, she seems like a woman. Not my mother, the vacuum cleaner queen, who rolls her eyes at the Garrett, at any uncertainty at all. I've only met Clay twice, really. He has charm, I guess, but apparently my dad did, too. Mom's always said that bitterly. Your father had charm, as though charm were some illicit substance he'd used on her that made her lose her mind. I clear my throat. So, I say, in what I hope is a casual making conversation tone, not a probing for info one. How much do you know about Clay Tucker? Mom's eyes snap to me. Why do you ask, Samantha? How is that your business? This is why I don't say things. I stick my spoon into my smoothie, squishing a slice of strawberry against the side. I just wondered, he seems... like a potential disaster? Younger? Probably not a tactful way to put it. Is there a tactful way to put it? So I don't finish my sentence, usually Mom's technique for getting us to tell all. Incredibly, it works in reverse. Well, one thing I do know is that he's gone a long way for a relatively young man. He advised the RNC during the last campaign. He's visited G.W. Bush at his Crawford Ranch. Well, ew. Tracy used to tease Mom about the reverent tone she used whenever she spoke the name of our former president. Mom has a crush on the commander-in-chief. I was always too creeped out by it to tease. Clay Tucker is a real mover and shaker, she says now. I can't believe he's taking time from my little campaign. I return the strawberries to the fridge, then root around my smoothie with my spoon, looking for more pieces of fruit that escaped the blender. How'd he wind up in Stony Bay? Did he bring a wife with him, a hometown honey? He bought his parents a summer house on Seashell Island. Mom opens the refrigerator and moves the strawberries from the second shelf, where I had put them, to the third shelf. That little island downriver? He's been burning himself out, so he came here for a little R&R. She smiles. Then he read about my race and couldn't help wanting to get involved. With the campaign? Or with Mom? Maybe he's some kind of secret agent, looking for ways to discredit her. But that would never work. She hasn't got any skeletons in the closet. Is that okay? I scoop out a strawberry and gobble it down. That you're sort of dating and he's, advising you? I thought that was a no-no. Mom's always been incredibly strict about the line between the political and the personal. A few years ago, Tracy forgot to bring money to pay for skates at McKinsey Rink, and the guy who ran it, a supporter of Mom's, said not to worry. Mom marched Tracy right in there the next day and paid full price, even though Trace was skating in off hours. Her eyebrows drew together. We're consenting adults, Samantha, unmarried. There are no rules being broken here. She lifts her chin, folding her arms. I resent your tone. But she's already gone to the closet door and pulled out the vacuum cleaner, cranking it up to the soothing roar of a 747. I occupy myself with my smoothie, wondering how I could have handled that better. Mom practically ran background checks on Charlie and Michael, not to mention some of Tracy's more dubious choices. But when it's her... The vacuum suddenly gives a guttural choking sound and stops dead. Mom shakes it, turns it off, unplugs it, tries again, but nothing. Samantha, she calls, do you know anything about this? Which I know from long experience means, are you responsible for this? No, Mom, you know I never touch it. She shakes it again accusingly. It was working fine last night. I didn't use it, Mom. Suddenly she's yelling. Then what's wrong with this thing? Of all the times for it to break, Clay's coming for dinner with some potential campaign donors, and the room's only half done. She slams the vacuum cleaner down. As usual, the living room is pristine. You can't even tell which side is the one she's just vacuumed. Mom, it'll be fine. They won't even notice. She kicks the vacuum cleaner, glaring at me. I'll notice. Okay. Mom, I'm used to her temper, but this seems over the top. Suddenly, abruptly, she unplugs the vacuum cleaner, gathers it up, walks across the room and throws it out the front door. It lands with a crash on the driveway. I stare at her. Don't you have to be at work, Samantha? Chapter 11. Then, of course, work is particularly annoying because Charlie Tyler and a bunch of the boys from school come in. Charlie and I broke up amiably, but this still means a lot of leering and, avast, what do I see through my spyglass, and jokes of the wanna-climb-my-main-mast variety. Naturally, they're at one of my tables, table 8, and they keep me running back and forth for water and extra butter and more ketchup just because they can. Finally, they get ready to leave. Thank God they overtip. Charlie winks at me as they go, working the dimples.
The mainmast offer stands, Sammy Sam.
Get lost, Charlie. I'm cleaning up their completely trashed table when someone tugs at the waistband of my skirt.
Kid.
Tim's unshaven, his rusty hair rumpled, still wearing the clothes he had on the last time I saw him. Flannel pajama bottoms incongruous in the summer heat. Clearly they haven't paid a visit to the washing machine.
Yo, I need some cash, rich girl.
This stings. Tim knows, or used to know, how much I hate that label, which got tossed at me by the kids on opposing swim teams. I'm not going to give you money, Tim.
'Cause I'll just spend it on booze, right?
He asks in a high, sarcastic voice, imitating Mom when we passed homeless people on visits to New Haven.
You know, that ain't necessarily so. I might spend it on weed. Or if you're generous and I'm lucky, blow. Come on, just give me 50.
He leans back against the counter, folding his hands and cocking his chin at me. I stare back. Face off? Then, unexpected, he lunges for the pocket of my skirt, where I stash my tips.
This is nothing to you. Don't know why the fuck you even work, Samantha. Just give me a few bucks.
I pull back, jerking away so abruptly I'm afraid the cheapo fabric of the skirt will tear.
Tim, come on. You know I'm not going to.
He shakes his head at me.
You used to be cool. When did you turn into such a bitch?
When you turned into such an asshole. I brush past him with my tray full of dirty dishes. Tears spring to my eyes. Don't, I think. But Tim used to know me as well as anyone could.
Trouble?
Ernesto, the cook, asks, looking up from the 6 frying pans he's got going simultaneously. Breakfast Ahoy is not a health food restaurant. Just some jerk. I dump the dishes into the bussing bin with a clatter.
Nothing new here. Damn town full of damn folks with silver spoons up their damn...
Oops, inadvertently activated Ernesto's favorite rant button. I tune him out, paste on a fierce smile, and go back to deal with Tim. But the flash of a dirty plaid pajama cuff and the slam of the door is the only sign of him. There's a skim of coins on the table by the door, and a few more on the ground. The rest of my tip is gone. There was this day a few weeks into 7th grade at Hodges, before Tim got kicked out, when I'd forgotten my lunch money and was looking for Tracy or Nan. Instead, I ran into Tim, sitting in the bushes with the worst of the Hodges stoner crowd. Tim, who, as far as I knew, till then, was as innocent of all that stuff as me and Nan. The hub of the crowd was Drake Marcos, the senior druggy guy who always hung with an equally well-baked posse. Quite the achievement for the college essay.
Oh, it's Tracy Reed's sister. Take a load off, Tracy Reed's sister. You look tense. You need to relax, Drake said.
The other kids laughed as though he was hysterically funny. I glanced at Tim, who was staring at his feet.
Walk on the wild side, Tracy Reed's sister.
Drake waved a bag of I didn't even know what at me. I made some lame comment about how I had to get to class, which Drake enjoyed riffing on for several seconds, with lots of sycophantic chortles from his loyal groupies. I started to leave, then turned back and called, "Come on," to Tim, who was still staring at his loafers. That was when he finally looked at me.
Fuck off, Samantha.
Chapter 12. It takes me a while to shake off Tim's visit, but things at Breakfast Ahoy come at you fast, and that helps. Today, however, it's all bad. The morning also features a woman who becomes extremely indignant when we can't allow our cockapoo to sit at the table with her, and a man with 2 extremely cranky toddlers who throw the jam and sugar packets at me and squirt mustard and ketchup into their napkin dispenser. As I walk home, I check my cell messages, finding one from Mom, still sounding peeved, telling me to clean the house.
Make it immaculate, she emphasizes, and then, make yourself scarce as Clay's bringing those donors over.
My mother has never asked me to make myself scarce. Is it because I asked about Clay? I walk up the driveway pondering this, then see the vacuum cleaner, still sprawled like a vagrant.
Samantha,
Jace calls from around the fence.
You okay? Looks like life was tough today on the bounding main.
No sailor jokes, please. Believe me, I've heard 'em all. He walks closer, smiling, shaking his head. Today he's wearing a white t-shirt that makes him look even tanner.
I bet you have. Seriously, are you all right? You look, disheveled, and that's rare for you.
I explain about cleaning the house and making myself scarce. And, I say as I kick it, the vacuum cleaner is broken.
I can fix that. Let me get my kit.
He jogs off before I can say anything. I go inside, ditch the sailor garb, and pull on a light blue sundress. I'm pouring lemonade when Jace knocks.
In the kitchen!
He comes in, carrying the vacuum cleaner in both arms like an accident victim, his toolkit dangling from one thumb.
Which is the part of your house that isn't clean?
My mother's kind of particular. Jace nods, raises an eyebrow, but doesn't say anything.
He sets the vacuum cleaner down on the tile, opens the toolbox, and cocks his head at it, searching for the right utensil, evidently. I stare at the muscles in his arms, and suddenly have such a strong urge to reach out and run my fingers down them that it scares me. Instead, I spray the countertop with disinfectant and attack it with a paper towel. Out, damned spot. He's got the vacuum cleaner fixed in less than 5 minutes. The culprit was apparently one of Clay's cufflinks. I suppress the image of Mom wrestling it off in a frenzy of cougar lust. Then Jace helps me re-clean the immaculate downstairs.
"Hard to feel him making progress when it was already so perfect," he says,
vacuuming under an armchair cushion as I adjust the already symmetrically aligned throw pillows.
"Maybe we should get George and Patsy over here, use some Play-Doh and finger paints, and then make brownies, so there's actually something to clean."
When we're done, Jace asks,
"Do you have a curfew?"
11 o'clock, I say, confused since it's just early afternoon.
"Get a jacket and your bathing suit, then."
"What are we doing?"
"You're supposed to make yourself scarce, right? Come get lost in the crowd at my house. Then we'll figure something out."
As always, the contrast between the Garrett's yard and ours is extreme. Dorothy walking out of black and white and into technicolor. Alice is playing frisbee with some guy. Little shrieks and screams are coming from the pool. Harry's whacking away at a t-ball stand, but with a tennis racket. Alice wings the frisbee at Jace, who catches it easily, and throws it to the guy. Not Cleve, who knew the score, but a hulking football player type. I hear Mrs. Garrett saying loudly from the pool area, "George, what did I tell you about peeing in here?" Then the screen door bursts open, and Andy charges out, carrying about 5 different bathing suits. "Alice, you have to help me." Alice rolls her eyes. "Just pick one, Andy. It'll be fine. It's only a date." Andy, a pretty 14-year-old with braces, shakes her head, looking near tears. "A date with Kyle. Kyle! Alice, I've never even been asked on a date, and now I have. And you won't even help."
"What's up, Anne?"
Jace walks over to her. "Kyle Comstock, from sailing camp. I've practically capsized the boat looking at him for 3 whole summers now. He asked me to go to the beach and then the clam shack. Alice is completely and totally no help whatsoever. All Mom says is to wear sunscreen." Alice shakes her head impatiently. "Come on, Brad, let's get wet." She and the football player type march off toward the pool. Jace introduces me to Andy, who turns anxious hazel eyes on me. "Can you help? No one should have to have a first date in a bathing suit. It's unfair." "You're right," I say. "Show me what you've got." Andy spreads the bathing suits out on the ground. 3 one-pieces, 2 bikinis. Mom says the bikinis are out. What do you think, Jace?
"No bikinis on a first date."
He nods.
"I'm sure that's a rule, or should be, for my sisters anyway."
"What's he like?" I ask, surveying the other suits. "Kyle? Oh, well, you know, perfect." She waves her hands.
"You need to be more specific, Anne," Jace says dryly.
"Funny, sporty, popular. Cute but doesn't act like he knows it. The kind who makes everybody laugh without trying too hard." "That one." I point to the red Speedo. "Thank you. What about after we swim? Do I change into a dress? Do I put on makeup? How do I even talk to him? Why did I agree to do this? I hate clams."
"Get a hot dog," Jace advises. "They're cheaper. He'll appreciate it."
"No makeup. You don't need it," I add, "especially after the beach. Throw some conditioner in your hair so it keeps the wet look. A dress is good. Ask lots of questions about him." "You have saved my very life. I shall be indebted to you for all eternity," Andy says fervently, and streaks back into the house.
"I'm fascinated," Jace observes in an undertone. "How did you decide which suit?"
"She said sporty," I respond. The skin at the back of my neck gives this little twitch at the sound of his voice so close to my ear. Plus her dark hair and tan skin with red. I'm probably jealous. My mom says blondes can't wear red.
Here I thought Sailor Supergirl could do anything.
Jace opens the door to the kitchen, motioning me in. Sadly, my powers are limited.
Can you make sure this Kyle Comstock is a good guy? That would be a useful power.
You're telling me, I say. I could use that one with my mom's boyfriend, but no. Without saying anything further, Jace heads for the stairs, and, snake-charmed again, I follow him up toward his room, to be met in the hallway by a very wide-eyed Duff. He has the family chestnut hair, slightly long, and round green eyes. He's huskier than Jace and a lot shorter.
"Voldemort has escaped," he announces.
"Hell."
Jace sounds upset, which, considering that info about Harry Potter is old news, seems odd.
"Did you take him out of his cage?"
Jace is at the door of his room in two strides.
"Just for a minute, to see if he was going to shed his skin soon."
"Duff, you know better."
Jace is on his knees, peering under the bed and the bureau. "Voldemort is..." I ask Duff.
"Jace's cornsnake. I named him."
It takes all my self-control not to leap onto the bureau. Jace is rummaging in the closet now.
"He likes shoes,"
he explains over his shoulder. Voldemort, the corn snake with the shoe fetish. Wonderful.
"Should I get Mom?"
Duff is poised in the doorway.
"Nope, got him."
Jace emerges from the closet with the orange, white, and black snake twined around his arm. I back up several paces.
"He's very shy, Samantha. Don't worry. Completely harmless. Right, Duff?"
"It's true."
Duff regards me seriously.
"Corn snakes are really underrated as pets. They're actually very gentle and intelligent. They just have a bad reputation, like rats and wolves."
"I'll take your word for it," I mutter, watching Jace uncoil the snake and slip it into its cage, where it lies curled like a big, deadly-looking bracelet.
"I can print out something on it from the internet if you like,"
Duff assures me.
"The one thing you have to be careful about with corn snakes is that sometimes they defecate when they're stressed."
"Duff, please go,"
Jace says. Duff, face downcast, leaves. Then Joel stalks into the room, wearing a tight black t-shirt, tighter black jeans, and an irritated expression.
"I thought you got it working. I have to pick up Giselle in 10 minutes.
"It was working,"
Jace says.
"Not now, bro. Take a look."
Jace looks at me apologetically.
"The motorcycle. Come with me while I check it."
Once again, it takes only a few minutes of Jace jiggling something and unscrewing and re-screwing something else for the motorcycle to purr to life. Joel hops on, says something that might be thanks, but is impossible to hear over the motor and speeds off.
"How did you get so good at everything?"
I ask Jace as he wipes his greasy hands on a rag from his toolkit.
"At everything?"
he repeats thoughtfully. "Fixing things." I gesture at the motorcycle, then at my house, implying the vacuum cleaner.
"My dad runs a hardware store. It gives me an unfair advantage."
"He's Joel's dad, too," I point out, "but you're the one fixing the motorcycle and taking care of all those pets." Jace's green eyes meet mine. Then his lashes lower.
"I guess I like things that take time and attention. More worthwhile that way."
I don't know what it is about this that makes me blush, but something does. Just then, Harry comes charging up, saying,
"Now you'll teach me to back dive, right, Sailor Supergirl? Right now, right?"
"Harry, Samantha doesn't have to."
"I don't mind," I say quickly, happy to have something to do besides melt into a puddle on the driveway. "I'll get my suit." Harry's an enthusiastic student, although his front dives are still at the making a steeple of his hands and belly flopping into the water stage. He keeps insisting I show him and show him again and again how to back dive, while Mrs. Garrett splashes in the shallow end with George and Patsy. Jace swims a few laps, then treads water, watching us. Alice and her Brad have evidently gone elsewhere.
"Did you know that killer whales don't usually kill people?"
George calls from the pool steps.
"I'd heard that, yes."
"They don't like the way we taste. And did you know that the deadliest sharks to people are great white, tiger, hammerheads, and bull sharks?"
"I did, George," I say, holding my hand in the small of Harry's back to get him at the proper angle.
"But there are none of those in this pool,"
adds Jace. Jace, do you think we should all go to the clam shack for dinner just to check on Andy? Mrs. Garrett asks.
She'd be completely humiliated, Mom.
Jace leans back against the side of the pool, elbows on the concrete surrounding it. I know, but honestly, 14 and dating? Even Alice was 15. He shuts his eyes.
Mom, you said no more babysitting for me this week, and Samantha's not on the clock either.
Mrs. Garrett wrinkles her forehead. I know, but Andy's just very young for 14. I don't know this Comstock boy at all. Jace sighs, shooting a glance at me. We could drop by the clam shack and check him out, I offer. Subtly, would that work? Mrs. Garrett beams at me.
An espionage date? Jace asks doubtfully. I guess that could work. Do you have a uniform for that one, Samantha?
I flick water at him with a jolt of happiness that he's calling it a date. Inside, I am no more suave than Andy. No Lara Croft look, if that's what you're after.
Too bad, he says, and splashes back at me.
Chapter 13. Kyle Comstock's father, a tall, handsome man with a long-suffering expression, pulls up in a black BMW soon after this. Kyle gets out and walks into the backyard looking for Andy. He's cute, with brownish-blonde curly hair and an infectious smile, undiluted by the braces. Andy in the red bathing suit, with a navy terry-cloth cover-up over it, hops into the car, after giving Jace and me a quick isn't-he-something look. When we get to the clam shack an hour later, it is, as usual, completely packed. The shack is a small, shabby building on Stony Bay Beach, approximately the size of my mom's walk-in closet. And all summer long there's a line outside. It's the only eatery on the beach, and Stony Bay is the biggest and best public one, wide and sandy. When we finally get in, we see Andy and Kyle over at a corner table. He's talking earnestly, and she's toying with her French fries, blushing as red as her bathing suit. Jace closes his eyes at the sight. Painful to watch when it's your sister? I ask.
I don't worry about Alice. She's like one of those spiders that bites the guy's head off when she's done with him. But Andy's different. Teenage heartbreak waiting to happen.
He looks around to see if there are any available seats, then asks,
Samantha, do you know that guy?
I look over to find Michael sitting alone at the counter, glaring moodily at us. Both ex-boyfriends in one day. Lucky me. He's, went out for a little while.
I guess. Jace seems amused. He looks like he's going to come up and challenge me to a duel.
No, but he will definitely write a hostile poem about you tonight, I say. There's no place to sit, so we end up carrying Jace's hamburger and my chowder outside and over to the breakwater. The sun's still high and hot in the sky, but there's a cool breeze. I pull on my jacket.
So what happened with emo dude? Bad breakup?
In a way, high drama. That was Michael. It's not like he was madly in love with me at all. That was the thing with Michael. I chew an oyster cracker, staring out at the water, the waves blue black. I was just sort of the girl in the poem, not myself. First I was the unattainable object, and then I was some golden girl who was supposed to save him from sorrow forever, or the siren who was luring him into having sex when he didn't want to. Jace chokes on a French fry.
Really?
I can feel myself flush. Not like that, he was just very Catholic, so he'd make a move and suffer over it for days.
Fun guy. We should hook him up with my ex, Lindy.
Lindy the shoplifter? I reach for one of his French fries, then snatch my hand back. He hands me the container.
That's the one, no conscience at all. Maybe they'd balance each other out.
Did you actually get arrested? I ask.
Escorted to the station in a police car, which was quite enough for me. I got a warning, but as it turned out, it was not Lindy's first offense when we were caught, so she got a big fine, which she wanted me to pay half of, and community service.
Did you pay half? I gobble another of Jace's fries. I'm trying not to look at him. In the honeyed evening light, the green eyes and tan skin and the amused curl of his smile are all just a little much.
I almost did because I felt like an ass. My dad talked me out of it since I had no idea what Lindy was doing. She could sweep a dozen things into her purse without blinking an eye. She'd practically cleaned out the makeup counter when the security guard came over. He shakes his head.
Michael wrote angry breakup poems, a few a day for 3 months, then mailed them to me, postage due.
Let's definitely set them up. They deserve each other.
He stands up, crumpling the waxed paper from the hamburger and stuffing it into his pocket.
Want to walk out to the lighthouse?
I'm chilly, but I want to go anyway. The breakwater that leads to the lighthouse is strange. The rocks are perfectly flat and even until about halfway, then get jagged and off-kilter, so walking all the way out involves a certain amount of climbing and clinging. By the time we reach the lighthouse, the evening light has turned from golden to pinkly golden with the sunset. Jace folds his arms on the black pipe metal railing and looks out at the ocean, still studded in the distance with tiny triangles of white sailboats headed home. It's so picturesque that I half expect orchestral chords to swell in the background. Tracy's a pro at these things. She'd stumble and bump up against the boy, looking at him through her lashes. Or she'd shiver and press herself a little closer, as if unconsciously. She'd know exactly what to do to get someone to kiss her, just when and how she wanted him to. But I don't have those skills. So I just stand next to Jace, leaning on the rail, watching the sailboats, feeling the heat of his arm resting next to mine. After a few minutes, he turns to look at me. That look of his, unhurried, thoughtful, scanning my face slowly. Are his eyes lingering on my eyes, lips? I'm not sure. I want them to. Then he says,
"Let's get home. We'll take the bug and go somewhere. Alice owes me."
As we clamber back over the rocks, I can't stop wondering what just happened there. I could swear he was looking at me like he wanted to kiss me. What's stopping him? Maybe he isn't attracted to me at all. Maybe he just wants to be friends? I'm not sure I can pull off being just friends with someone whose clothes I want to rip off. Oh God, did I actually just think that? I steal another look at Jace in his jeans. Yes, yes I did. We look in again at Andy and Kyle. Now she's talking, and he's taken one of her hands in his and is just looking at her. That seems promising. When we get to the Garrett's house, their van is gone. We walk into the living room to find Alice and her Brad sprawled on the brown sectional couch, Brad rubbing Alice's feet. George is fast asleep, naked, face down on the floor. Patsy is wandering around in purple terry cloth footy pajamas, plaintively saying, "Boob!"
"Alice, Patsy should be in bed."
Jace scoops her up, her little purple bottom so small in his broad hand. Alice seems surprised to find the baby still there, as though Patsy should have tucked herself in long ago. Jace goes to the kitchen to get a bottle, and Alice sits up, looking at me through narrowed eyes, as though trying to place me. Her hair is now dark red, with some sort of shiny gel making it stick up every which way. After eyeing me for several minutes, she says, "You're Tracy Reed's sister, aren't you?" "I know, Tracy." Her tone implies that in this particular case, to know Tracy is not to love her. "Yep, from next door."
"You and Jace seeing each other?"
"Friends." "Don't hurt him. He's the nicest guy on the planet." Jace comes back into the room in time to hear this and rolls his eyes at me privately. Then he scoops the sleeping George easily into his arms, looking around the room.
"Where's Happy?"
Alice, who's settled back into Brad's lap, shrugs.
"Alice, if George wakes up and there's no Happy, he's gonna totally lose it." "Is Happy the plastic dinosaur?"
Brad asks.
"'Cause that's in the bathtub." "No, Happy is the stuffed beagle."
Jace rummages around under the couch for a minute, emerging with Happy, who has evidently led a long and eventful life.
"I'll just be a sec."
He walks by me, letting one palm rest for a moment in the small of my back. "I mean it," Alice says flatly once he's gone. "You screw with him, you deal with me." She sounds fully capable of hiring a hitman if I make the wrong move. Yikes. Opening the door to Alice's car, an aged white VW Bug, Jace scoops up about 50 CDs from the passenger seat, then flips open the glove compartment to try to store them there. A lacy red bra falls out.
Jesus,
he says, shoving it hastily back in and burying it in CDs.
Not yours, I take it, I say. I really need to get my own car, he says. Want to go to the lake?
Just as we start to pull out of the driveway, Mr. and Mrs. Garrett peel in and park, kissing like teenagers, her arms looped around his neck, his hands in her hair. Jace shakes his head as though a little embarrassed, but I stare at them.
What's it like? I ask.
He's backing up, his arm resting along the back of my seat.
It?
Having happy parents. Together parents. Two parents.
You never had that?
Nope, I have never met my dad. I'm not even sure where he lives anymore.
Jace frowns at me. No child support?
Nope, my mom has a trust fund. I think he tried to get some sort of settlement, but ditching her when she was pregnant counted against him.
I'd hope, Jace mutters. I'm sorry, Samantha. Having together parents is all I know. It's like home base. I can't imagine not having that.
I shrug, wondering why I do this with Jace. I've never had a problem keeping stuff private. Something about Jace's quiet watchfulness just makes me talk. It takes about 15 minutes to get to the lake, which is on the far side of town. I haven't been here often. I know it's sort of a public school hangout. There's some rite of passage where a lot of the seniors jump in fully clothed on the last day of school. I expect the lake to be crowded with parked cars with steamy windows, but no one else is in the lot when we pull in. Jace reaches into the back of the VW, pulls out a towel, then takes my hand and we walk through the trees to the shore. It's much warmer than it was at the beach, no ocean breeze.
Race you to the float, he says, pointing to a shape dimly visible in the gathering dark.
I shake off my jacket and yank off my sundress, my bathing suit still underneath, then start to run for the water. The lake is cool and silky, the water softer than ocean water. The eel grass beneath my feet stops me for a moment as I try not to think of trout and snapping turtles lurking below. Jace is already swimming fast, and I hurry to catch up. He beats me anyway and is standing on the float to pull me up when I get there. I look around at the quiet water, the distant shore, and I shiver as his hand closes on mine.
What am I doing here with you? I ask.
What?
I hardly know you. You could be some serial killer luring me out to a deserted lake.
Jace laughs and lies down on the dock on his back, folding his arms behind his head.
Nah, I'm not. And you can tell.
How can I tell? I smile at him, lying down beside him, our hips nearly touching. The whole happy family Mr. Nice Guy bit could be a cover.
No, because of instinct. You can tell who to trust. People can, just like animals. We don't listen as well as they do always, but it's still there. That prickly feeling when something's not right. That calm feeling when it is.
His voice is low and husky in the darkness.
Jace?
Mm-hmm. He lifts up on one elbow, his face barely visible in the twilight.
You have to kiss me, I find myself saying.
Yeah. He leans closer.
I do.
His lips, warm and soft, touch my forehead, then slide down my cheek, moving sideways to my mouth. His hand comes up to press the nape of my neck beneath my wet hair, just as mine slips to his back. His skin's warm beneath the cool sheen of water, his muscles tight as he lies there, still balanced on one elbow. I curl in closer. I'm not new to kissing, or I thought I wasn't, but it's never been anything like this. I can't get close enough. When Jace gently deepens the kiss, it feels right. No moment of startled hesitation like I've had before. After a long time, we swim back to shore and stretch out for a while on our towels, kissing again. Jace's lips smiling under mine as I kiss all over his face, my hands tightening on his shoulders as he nuzzles my neck and softly nibbles my collarbone. It is as if everything else in the world stops as we lie here in the summer night.
"We should go home,"
Jace whispers, his hands stroking my waist. "No, not yet. Not yet," I say back, sliding my lips along the willing curve of his. Chapter 14. Punctual to a fault, I've never understood the expression, "I lost track of time." I've never lost track of anything. Not my cell phone, not my homework, not my work schedule. Certainly not time. But this night, I do. When we climb into the car, it's 5 of 11. I try to quell the panic in my tone as I remind Jace of my curfew. He speeds up a little but stays within the limit, reaching out a calming hand to touch my knee.
"I'll come in with you,"
he offers as we pull into the circular drive.
"Explain that it was my fault."
"No." The headlights of the VW illuminate a Lexus parked in our driveway. "Clay? One of those donors?" As I fumble with the door latch, my hand is sticky with sweat. I'm scrambling for a plan, a mom-acceptable excuse. She was not in the best of moods this morning. Unless the donors showered her with money, and probably even if they did, I'm in big trouble. I have to just go in the front door, because chances are, my mother has already checked my bed. "Good night, Jace," I call hurriedly, and run without looking back. I start to open the door, but then it opens swiftly from inside, and I practically fall in. Mom standing there, her face taut with fury.
"Samantha Christina Reed," she begins. "Do you know what time it is?"
"After curfew, I know. I..." She shakes the wine glass in her hand at me, as if it's a wand that will render me mute.
"I'm not going through this with you too, do you hear me? I've done all the troubled teenager parenting I have time for with your sister. I don't need this, do you understand?"
"Mom, I'm only 10 minutes late."
"That's not the point." Her voice rises. "The point is that you don't get to do it. I expect better from you, this summer especially. You know I'm under a lot of pressure. This is not the time for your adolescent drama."
I cannot help but wonder if any parents ever actually schedule in adolescent drama on their day planners. "Looks like a slow week, Sarah. I guess I can pencil in your eating disorder." "This isn't drama," I tell her, which rings so true to my ears. "Mom is drama. Tim is drama. Sometimes even Nan is drama. Jace and the Garretts? They're whatever the opposite of drama is. The tidal pool warm in the summer sun, full of exotic life but no danger."
"Don't contradict me, Samantha," Mom snaps. "You're grounded."
"Mom!"
"What's going on, Grace?"
asks a softly accented southern voice, and Clay wanders out of the living room, sleeves rolled up, tie loose around his neck.
"I'm handling it," Mom tells him sharply.
I half expect him to pull back as though she slapped him, which I want to do when she gets that tone, but his posture relaxes even more. He leans back against the doorway, flicks something off his shoulder, and says simply,
"Seems like you could use my help."
Mom's so tightly wound she's practically vibrating. She's always been private, would never yell at Tracy and me if we were even remotely in public. Then we'd just get a terse whisper, "We will discuss this later." But it's Clay, and her hand shoots up to pat her hair in that silly, coy gesture I've only seen her use with him.
"Samantha's late for curfew. She has no excuse for that."
"Well, she hasn't exactly given me a chance to offer one. But true, I don't know what I'd say in my own defense." Clay looks at his Rolex.
"Curfew's when, Gracie?"
11, Mom says, her voice smaller now. Clay lets out a rich, low laugh.
11 o'clock on a summer night? And she's 17? Honey, that's when we all miss curfew."
He walks over, reaches to squeeze the back of her neck lightly.
"I know I did. I'm sure you did."
His hand moves to her chin, edging it so she's looking right at him.
"Give a little here, sugar."
Mom stares at his face. I'm holding my breath. I shoot a glance at my unlikely rescuer. He winks at me, giving Mom's chin a nudge with his knuckles. In his eyes, there's not a trace of guilt or, and I'm surprised at how relieved I feel, complicity about what he knows I saw. Maybe I overreacted, she says finally, to him, not to me. But I'm beginning to wonder the same thing. Maybe there's an easy explanation for the brunette.
We all do it, Gracie. Why don't I get you some more wine?
He scoops the glass out of her unresisting fingers and heads off to the kitchen as though it's his own. Mom and I both stand there. Your hair's wet, she says at last. You'd better shower with conditioner, or it'll dry tangly. I nod and turn to go up the stairs. Before I've gone far, I hear her behind me. But I act as though I don't, proceeding into my room and flopping face down on my bed, still wearing my wet bathing suit and damp sundress. The mattress dips as Mom sits down.
Samantha, why would you provoke me like this?
I didn't. It's not about... She starts rubbing my back the way she did when I had nightmares when I was little.
Sweetie, you just don't understand how hard it is to be a parent, much less a single one. I've been working without a map since you both were born, never knowing if I'm making the right call. Look at Tracy and the shoplifting incident. And you and that Michael, who might have been doing drugs for all I know.
Mom, he didn't do drugs. I've told you that before. He was just weird.
Be that as it may, this is the sort of thing I can't have going on during the campaign. I need to focus. I can't have you distracting me with these antics.
Antics? Like I've returned stark naked in the wee hours of the morning, reeking of alcohol and pot? She strokes my back a few more minutes, then frowns. Why is your hair wet? The lie slips out easily, though I've never lied to Mom before. I took a shower at Nan's. We were trying on makeup and doing a conditioning treatment.
Ah.
Then, her voice low. I'm keeping an eye on you, Samantha. You've always been my good girl. Just act like it, okay? I always have, and this is where I've wound up. Still, I whisper, okay, and lie very still beneath her fingers. Finally, she stands up, says goodnight, and leaves. After about 10 minutes, I hear a tapping at my window. I freeze, listening for evidence that Mom heard too. But all's quiet downstairs. I open the window to find Jace crouching on my balcony.
I wanted to make sure you were okay.
Then, looking closely at my face,
are you?
Wait a minute, I tell him, practically shutting the window on his fingers. I hurry to my door, to the top of the stairs, and shout down, I'm taking that shower now, Mom.
Use conditioner,
she calls back, sounding much more relaxed. I duck into the bathroom, turn the water on full blast, and return to open the window. Jace seems perplexed.
Everything all right?
Mom's a little protective. I fling one leg, then the other out the window, and sit down next to Jace, who's folded himself comfortably against the gable. The night breeze is sighing past us, and the stars are so bright.
This was my fault. I was driving. Let me talk to your mom. I'll tell her.
I imagine Jace being confronted by Mom. That I missed curfew for the first time while in the company of one of those Garretts would confirm for her everything she's ever said about them. I just know it. It wouldn't help. He reaches out, folding my cold hand in his warm one. Apparently feeling the chill, his other palm closes on it too.
You sure you're okay?
I would be if I didn't keep picturing Mom coming up to make sure I was using enough conditioner and finding me out here. I swallow. I'm fine. See you tomorrow? He leans forward, my hand still enclosed in his, moving his lips from the bridge of my nose down to my mouth, coaxing it open. I start to relax into him, then think I hear a knock. I've got to go. Good night? He gives my hand a squeeze, then me a grin so dazzling it squeezes my heart even harder. Yeah, see you tomorrow. Despite those kisses, I can't relax. 10 minutes late in a lifetime, and I'm an issue for the campaign? Maybe Mom and the Masons can get a discount on military school if they ship me and Tim off together. I stop the shower, slamming the frosted glass door loudly. In my room, I pick up my pillow, punching it into shape. I don't know how I'll sleep. My body's tight. In this moment, if Charlie Tyler made a pass at me, I'd go all the way, even knowing it meant nothing to him. If Michael actually were a drug addict and offered me instant oblivion, I'd take it, even though I hesitate before taking an aspirin. If Jace knocked on the window again and told me we were going to take a motorcycle trip to California right now, I'd go. What's the use of being the me I've always been when my mother is hardly recognizable? Chapter 15. The next time I babysit, Mrs. Garrett takes me grocery shopping so I can entertain the kids and wrestle junk food out of their hands while she scans her stack of her coupons and expertly fields commentary. "You certainly have your hands full." She hears that one a lot. "With good things," she responds calmly, removing Count Chocula cereal from George's eager grasp. "You must be Catholic," is another she gets time and time again. "No, just fertile." She peels Harry's hands away from the latest Transformer action hero. "That baby needs a hat," lectures a severe-looking elderly woman in the freezer aisle. "Thank you, but not really. She has several nice ones at home." Mrs. Garrett picks up an economy-sized box of frozen waffles and adds it to the cart. I hand Patsy a bottle of juice, prompting a crunchy granola-looking woman in Birkenstocks to say, "That baby is much too old for a bottle. She should be on a sippy cup by now." Who are these people? And why do they think their own opinions are the only right ones? "Don't you ever just want to kill them or at least swear at them?" I ask in an undertone, steering the cart away from the crabby sippy cup woman, with Harry and George clinging to either side like spider monkeys. "Of course," Mrs. Garrett shrugs, "but what kind of example would that be?" I've lost track of how many laps I've done, but I know it's less than I used to be able to do, and I'm winded but invigorated when I climb the ladder, squeezing water from my hair. I've loved swimming ever since I can remember, ever since I was brave enough to follow Tim out of the safe shallows into the bigger waves. I'm going to get back on that team. I dash the towel across my face, check the clock, 15 minutes till the pool opens, which is usually accompanied by a surge of people through the gates. My cell phone buzzes on my chair. "Take a break, Aqua Girl," Nan's texted me from the B&T gift shop. "Come see me." Stony Bay is very proud of Stony Bay. The B&T's gift shop, by the Bay Buys, is chock-a-block full of items advertising various town landmarks. As I walk in, Nan is already open for business, saying sweetly to a gentleman in pink plaid shorts, "As you can see, you could get this mouse pad of Main Street, and then these placemats with the aerial view of the river mouth, this little lamp that looks like our lighthouse, and these coasters with the view of the dock, and you wouldn't need to go outside at all. You could see the whole town from your dining room." The man appears nonplussed, either by Nan's soft-spoken sarcasm or by the idea of spending so much money.
"I really only wanted these," he says, holding up some napkins that say, "One martini, two martini, three martini, floor." "Can you put them on my club tab?"
After Nan rings him up and he leaves, she crosses her eyes at me. My first day on the job and I'm already regretting this. If all the sanctification of Stony Bay stuff brainwashes me, and I tell you I need to join the garden club, you'll get me deprogrammed, right? "I'll be there for you, sister. Have you seen Tim? He was supposed to get here 10 minutes early, so I can show him his uniform and all that." Nan checks her watch. "He's not officially late yet. 2 more minutes. How did I get the most boring job with the longest hours in town? I only took it because Mrs. Gritzmacher, who does the buying, is married to Mr. Gritzmacher, the bio teacher, who I want to write a recommendation for me." "This is the price of your ruthless ambition," I say. "It's not too late to repent and work for the greater good, like at Breakfast Ahoy." Nan grins at me, her hundreds of freckles already darkening with the summer sun. "Yeah, well, I'm saving my naughty sailorette costume for Halloween." She glances out the window behind me. "Besides, It's going to take both of us to babysit my brother if he can get himself fired from a hot dog stand.
How exactly did he do that? I ask, opening one of the sample lip glosses on the checkout counter, rubbing it on my finger and smelling it. Ick, piña colada, I hate coconut.
Asked people how hot they wanted their wiener, Nan says absently. He's out there now, by the concession stand. Go make sure he's not a disaster.
Given our last encounter, I approach warily. Tim's leaning against my lifeguard chair, wearing dark glasses even though it's cloudy. Not a good sign. I edge closer to him. He used to be so easygoing, Nan's opposite. Now he's a time bomb who might detonate in your hands. So I say hesitantly, "You okay?"
"Fine."
His voice is abrupt. Either he hasn't forgiven me for not being his ATM, or he's got a headache. Probably both.
"Seriously? Because this job is, well, serious."
"Yep, the fate of the world depends on what goes down at the lagoon pool at the B&T. I get it. I'm your man."
He salutes without looking at me, then squirts sunscreen into his palm to rub on his pale chest. "Honestly, you can't mess around here, Tim. There are little kids and..." His hand on my arm silences me.
Yeah, screw the lecture, Princess Buttercup. I know."
Taking off his sunglasses, he jabs them at his heart for emphasis with a phony smile.
"I'm hungover, but I'm straight. I'll save the partying for after hours. Now get off my back and do your job."
"You're part of my job. I'm supposed to show you where the uniforms are. Hang on." I position the lifeguard off-duty sign more prominently on my chair, walk through the bushes to the lagoon pool, and set that one up too. A bunch of moms standing outside the gate with their children and their arms full of floaties look annoyed.
"Just 5 more minutes, I call, adding in an authoritative tone, "Need to resolve a safety issue."
Tim's sweaty and preoccupied as he follows me through the labyrinthine course to the room where uniforms are kept. We pass the bathrooms with their heavy oak doors, thick iron latches, and signs that say, "Salty dogs and gulls," then spell it out in nautical flags.
"I'm gonna throw up," he says.
"Yeah, it's ludicrous, but..." He grabs my sleeve.
"I mean, really? Wait."
He vanishes into the men's room. Not good. I move away from the door so I don't have to hear. After about 5 minutes, he comes back out.
"What?"
he asks belligerently. "Nothing."
"Right," he mutters.
We get to the uniform room. "So here's your suit and stuff." I shove the towel, hat, jacket, and whistle that come with the job, along with the gold crest, embossed navy blue board shorts, into his hands.
"You gotta be kidding. I can't wear my own suit."
"Nope. You need to display the B&T crest," I say, attempting a straight face.
"Fuck me, Samantha. I can't wear these. How am I supposed to pick up hot girls and get laid?"
"You're supposed to be saving lives, not scamming on girls."
"Shut up, Samantha."
Seems as though all our conversations run into the same dead end. I reach over and scoop up the hat with its jaunty insignia, plopping it on his head. It's removed even faster than Tim can say,
"That will be an extra helping of hell no with the hat. Do you wear one of these?"
"No, for some reason only the male lifeguards get that. I get the little jacket with the crest."
"Well, not this guy. I'd just as soon go and drag."
I can't worry about Tim. It's pointless. Besides, this isn't a job that allows for downtime. At the far end of the Olympic pool, a group of elderly women are taking a water aerobics class. Despite the rope blocking off that section, kids keep cannonballing into the class, splashing the ladies and upsetting their fragile balance. There's always a baby who doesn't have a swim diaper, despite the many signs saying this is a must, and I have to talk to the mother, who usually gets antagonistic. "Peyton was toilet trained at 11 months. She doesn't need a diaper." At 2 o'clock, the pool's nearly empty and I can relax a little. The moms have taken little kids home for naps. No one here but tanners and loungers. I'm overheated and sticky from sitting so long in the high plastic chair. Clambering down, I blow my whistle and hoist the lifeguard off-duty sign, thinking I'll get a soda at the snack bar to cool off.
I'm taking a break. Can I get you something to drink? I call over to Tim.
Only if it's 80 proof.
He calls back through the bushes and granite stones that separate the Olympic pool from the lagoon one.